This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Today on the program, our topic is the social and political impact of tourism. Journalist Patricia Goldstone is our guest. She's the author of Making the World Safe for Tourism. She says tourism has a tendency to lead governments toward greater social repression. We'll talk with her about her thesis, as well as the impacts of tourism she sees in countries like Ireland, Cuba, and Turkey. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion. Your questions and comments are encouraged. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Patricia Goldstone is a freelance journalist and playwright. Her book, Making the World Safe for Tourism, is published by Yale University Press. Again, those telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. Patricia Goldstone, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon to you, Celeste.
The conventional wisdom is that tourism helps lessen repression. There's less repression when a country is open to outsiders. And some people believe tourism can help lead a country to peace and democracy. So is the conventional wisdom wrong?
Well, I think the proper answer to that is yes and no. In some countries, such as Cuba and the former USSR, the privatization of state-owned tourism operators has seamlessly incorporated the old elite into the new. In Cuba, for example, the military has marched straight into executive positions in Cubanacan and Gaviota, which are the two largest tourism companies. Of course, the case for democracy by tourism in Cuba is not advanced by the fact that Tourism Minister Osmani Cienfuegos once commanded a death squad, or that Castro has praised Cuban women as the best educated and cleanest prostitutes in the world. In other countries, such as Egypt and Turkey, the military is deployed in full force to protect foreigners from anyone who might wish to kill the goose that lays the golden egg. And my observation was that the souped-up security probably makes those countries less democratic instead of more so.
Mm. And Ireland's situation. Here we have a country that has used tourism to become one of the fastest-growing economies, if not the fastest-growing economy in the world.
Well, I think tourism has been highly successful in Ireland, but I think that is largely because Ireland was highly democratic. To begin with, even in the north, I remember when I was a graduate student there, it was relatively easy to travel across the borders, do your shopping in Northern Ireland, work up there, and there was, there was always a fair amount of to-ing and fro-ing. So I don't think Ireland started out from the same place as a country like Cuba.
You say tourism requires social control. What kind of social control? How does that operate?
Well, again, I think this is a security issue in countries where tourism has been highly successful, like Egypt, for example. Terrorists have learned exactly where to aim if they wish to bring down the economy and create as much social disruption as possible. A particularly good example of that was Luxor in 1997, when a number of tourists were killed by Islamic militants, and it essentially shut down the country's tourist economy for 3 years. They're just recovering, and recovering very strongly, I'm pleased to say.
Mm. You say that this is one of the problems with tourism, that it can become a one-trick economy, and that, like having just one crop to depend on, it can be disastrous.
Well, I think that in countries, again, like Cuba, it's hard to imagine what they would do without tourism if, for example, the U.S. stock market suddenly headed down. But, this problem arises because of the way tourism developed in the 20th century. It became very popular as an economic tool in the period after World War II, when many countries were decolonizing and tourism was seen as a means of weaning them from very narrow commodities economies, like sugar, like oil, like rubber, for example.
Worldwide, how big an industry is tourism?
Tourism, according to its own statistics, is enormous. It has indeed grown enormously in the past 20 years, and today claims to be the world's biggest business. If its statistics are correct, it employs 1 in 9 adults, or 200 million people worldwide, and contributes 11% of all tax payments. These are very big numbers.
And how stable is this industry? I mean, in terms of, it seems to me that it is very dependent on wealth and the wealth of individuals.
I think that's a fair observation. And one of its biggest problems, it is notoriously skittish. It's vulnerable both to acts of terrorism and snags in the business cycle. Certainly in the last decade, its growth has depended on the heady gains of the U.S. stock market and on aging baby boomers who have not yet opted to stay home. But if and when they do, the vacuum could conceivably threaten political stability in some countries.
We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 1 in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hi. I had a comment and a question, and my comment was that, and I don't know if you meant to do this, but in the former, I mean, I think it's a little misleading to say that the Army stepped in and taken over the tourism industry and that the tourism industry is sort of, it sounded like that was a causal. I mean, I think in the former Soviet Union and Cuba, for example, the Army has stepped in virtually everywhere. And as well as the intelligence operations, they've taken over almost all the private enterprises, or a huge number of them are in very highly placed positions in every field you can imagine. So I think that point needs to be made. I mean, I'm certain that they're in tourism too, but they're in oil, they're in natural gas, they're in manufacturing. I mean, the command economy in the Soviet Union was set up such that the Army was the only really organization that could take it over. I think that's a terrible thing because, like you mentioned, the death squad in Cuba, and I'm sure in other South and Central American countries, they've just sort of disappeared into the new capitalist structure. And my question is that you mentioned Ireland and Egypt, and I was surprised to hear that tourism accounts for so much. Can you give us some figures on maybe what percentage of their economy it does? Because I thought Ireland was enjoying a pretty substantial high-tech boom at the current time, as well as Egypt has, substantial oil reserves. And I'll hang up before my kids shoot me.
Well, according to the material I received from the Irish government, tourism has edged out agriculture as the country's biggest industry. Yes, they have a good deal of high tech, but tourism is the number one industry there. And as far as the point you were making about Cuba is concerned, I think it is a good point. But tourism is particularly attractive to both military and intelligence forces because it provides access to foreigners as well as to hard currency, and that is highly desirable.
The caller also mentioned high tech as an important part of the economies of Ireland and Egypt. You want to comment on that?
Well, Ireland certainly, and I think that Ireland benefits a great deal from the fact that it has a highly educated English-speaking workforce, and it has been relatively easy for Ireland to use tourism as a platform and then step from what is essentially service economy into information technology. In countries where English is not the first language, I think that is considerably more difficult.
How did you come to this point of view that you're thinking about tourism and its and the impact of it on politics, economies, and societies?
Well, I have always traveled a lot. I have always traveled, I think, as something of a bohemian. And I think that I became aware of a deep sea change around 1990 when I was shipped off on a glasnost junket to eastern Finland. And we were involved in a rather large performance piece that celebrated the breaking down of boundaries. And my perception of it as an artist was that it wasn't very good. And I was very curious, since I had spent a number of years working in New York and trying to raise money for projects that had some merit. I was aware of exactly how difficult that is, and I was fascinated by what seemed to be the rather large sums of money being lavished on this performance piece, and began to feel that there was a larger agenda behind it, that it was part of something political, that it was perhaps part of an economist's five-year plan. And then I started noticing a bulge in travel pieces that were geared towards countries like Myanmar, which was very dangerous. And I found myself wondering, now who in their right minds would really go vacation in Myanmar, and why is this being promoted at this particular time, which of course happened to be the kickoff point for the peace process around 1993.
Myanmar, also known as Burma.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, this one on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi. I don't want to go on too long about Cuba, but I wanted to at least point out that prior to 59, the people that were running the tourism trade were fairly unsavory, too. It's a matter of record that Meyer Lansky, the mobster, his legitimate company was called Resorts International, which is still traded on the market, and they were big into the resort scene. And so I don't know. Have you done some trips to Cuba? Are you doing firsthand on this? Or
yes, I did this firsthand, and my observation was that indeed the glory days under Meyer Lansky were being resurrected. That it was still a sun and sin destination.
So one trip, you think, or how many times
did
you go?
I just took one trip, and that was in 1998.
Did you go with just a tourist or status, or did you go with any other kind of organization? Because there are some admirable organizations that are touring Cuba, and you do things besides just sun and sex. But anyway, I'm sure our host doesn't want to get into our angle on this either. I wanted to ask about Quintana Roo and the way the Mexican government sort of pick that area out. I mean, it was already sort of a resort, given the evidence of Isla Mujeres, which was already a kind of resort in this destination. But they sort of consciously looked around and what other coastal area can we develop? And consequently, it was maybe still the case that, you know, the people that worked the resorts there were sort of living in cardboard boxes that were left over from the shipping things in to the place. And I think it's probably another good example of using tourism as a development process, but how much of it really gets to the people?
Well, that's the significant question. Quintana Roo is not a development that I'm personally familiar with, but my perception in Cuba, to which I traveled to do the research for this book by myself with a translator, my perception was that the money was not filtering down to the people in any significant amounts. I still saw a lot of food shortages. I saw a lot of electricity shortages. The housing in back of the hotel strips was wretched. And it struck me as a sad place.
Yeah, that's all available in most Thailand and Quintana Roo, if you will, which is, for people who don't recognize the provincial name, that's Cancun and that whole area.
Mm-hmm.
So, I just think that one must look at history, and I'm not sure. I guess I should look at your book before I form opinions. But I think it's not a difference of degree. I mean, I think all these areas where they're lesser developed countries that are trying to do tourism are failing in ways more or less of reinvesting and actually getting the money to actual real development, which helps people. There is the case that Cuba has been recognized this past week as very environmentally aware and urban garden city, that kind of thing. In fact, they're having the UN is having their World Environment Conference there in the next year. So I think people can dig a little deeper and go past some of the platitudes and commonplaces. So I'll let you expand. Thanks.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Patricia Goldstone, you want to comment on the caller's comments?
It was a very long comment. I think he's making a good point. I think primarily because in so many of these countries, the profits that are made through tourism either stay within a very elite group or go offshore. It's hard to make a case for tourism as a means to lift all boats. And I think that's really the essence of what he is saying.
Part of your book provides an interesting look into big business and how it has profited from tourism and the democratizing potential of tourism. You write about American Express, Boeing, some other companies. And I'd like to talk a little bit about American Express. It's a very interesting story. You say American Express revolutionized the demographics of travel with the traveler's check.
That's right.
When and how did the traveler's check appear?
Well, the traveler's check was originally called a money order, and it appeared around the end of the 19th century. It revolutionized travel because it made it easy to transport money. Checking accounts up until that point had really been the provenance of the wealthy. And the money order made it possible even for immigrants who were by that point arriving in waves, of course, to develop the frontier, to work the railways, who could not speak English. Typically, these customers would pay for their money orders in cash, in full, on a no-interest basis. The money would stay in the coffers of American Express until the order was cashed, which was usually some months given the duration of travel in these days. And the amount of the surplus, which became known as the float, fluctuated. But as the volume of money orders grew, so did the float. It grew exponentially until American Express had a formidable cash reserve, which ultimately became an independent, unregulated currency, open to no scrutiny but that of American Express's own executives.
And the company you also write in the book reinvented the nature of travel. How so?
Well, I think in a couple of ways. American Express was the first to promote travel as a means of democratization. It piggybacked itself after World War II when air travel also was booming and becoming affordable for the masses. By advertising travel essentially as an extension of the Marshall Plan. In other words, if people would go to Europe and spend their dollars, they would be serving the purposes of democracy by bringing in hard currency and keeping the borders open. That's one way. I think also American Express has, although others like Thomas Cook's, for example, have done this, American Express has sort of perfected the package, the safe, cocooned environment, which I think now generally insulates travelers from the very thing they wish to see and experience.
Back to that idea of marketing tourism as an extension of the Marshall Plan. You know, is that an example, though, of a win-win situation?
I think at that time it was. It drew people to Europe to spend money in great numbers, and here everyone benefited, I think. It was a great period in music and culture of all sorts, largely because Europe was still very cheap, and you could still go over there and live, and people could could experience another culture and each other far more easily, I think, than they can today.
Yeah. And it was a serviceman who came back to the United States and wrote Europe on $5 a day.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Still in the business today.
Mm-hmm. Try doing that now.
Have the World Bank and the IMF played a role in global tourism? What's been their impact?
Well, yes, indeed. Again, this is sort of a PR idea, the big idea being that tourism can make the world safe for democracy by bringing travelers and their dollars into previously inaccessible and often still dangerous places, thereby opening them to Western ways and Western trade. The reality is that, at least according to the UN, tourism is the only large sector of international trade where countries have consistently posted a surplus. In other words, it is a reasonably sure way to boost hard currency receipts, which can then be used to pay off foreign loans in short order. This, of course, makes it a favorite of the World Bank and the IMF.
Are there many countries that have become dependent on tourism for foreign currency?
Well, again, Cuba is one prime example. At the time that I was there in 1998, the entire value of the Cuban economy was quoted to me as $2.5 billion. $1.8 million of that was represented by tourism. That's an enormous part of the pie.
What about Thailand?
Well, Thailand is... Is again, I think, a rather depressing example. Thailand has become the world's sexual Disneyland through tourism and through sex tourism in particular. Now, sex may not be the first thing you think of when you hear the words World Bank. But as public sector funds have accrued to globalize tourism, the business of sex tourism has ridden on its back, so to speak. Some see a direct link between the bank and the globalization of the sex biz. I feel that that's a bit extreme. But it is true that Robert McNamara was Secretary of Defense when the U.S. military signed an R&R contract with Thailand in 1967 and flotillas of troop ships hove into Thai ports looking for brothels, bars, and massage parlors. Later, when McNamara became president of the World Bank, he urged Thais to make an all-out effort to attract rich foreigners to the country's tourist facilities to help pay off their agricultural loans. A Thai minister rather freely interpreted this and urged his fellow countrymen and women to consider working as sexual entertainers in order to create jobs. Today, as I said, Thailand is considered the world's sexual Disneyland and has joined a host of other Asian countries in protesting this particularly ugly form of neocolonialism.
Are there countries now who are saying loud and clear to the IMF and the World Bank, thanks but no thanks?
Well, they are certainly being very vocal. Some go so far as to blame national and international economic planning for intentionally prostituting entire nations by undermining agriculture and traditional land ownership. This seems far-fetched, but it may be tempting for governments to rely on the quick fix of tourist dollars by whatever means, as more traditional commodities like sugar, rice, rubber, and oil prove unreliable in the global market. However, it has to be said, they do still take the money. All of the countries in a third world tourism study said that their governments could not afford not to take advantage of money from tourism because they must earn ever more income to pay off foreign debts, to feed corrupt and inefficient bureaucracies, and to buy more technology for their military.
Patricia Goldstone is our guest this afternoon. She's a freelance journalist and playwright. She lives in New York. She is the author of Making the World Safe for Tourism. The book is published by Yale. Listeners, your questions and comments are invited. In Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-2. 800-222-9455-333, WILL 800-222-WILL. I'd like to go back to Ireland. Really interesting.
So would I.
Really interesting chapter in the book devoted to Ireland. And here, this was interesting to see how, to think about how things come together. For instance, in the case of Ireland, you quote a film critic in the chapter by the name of Alexander Walker,
yes,
who sees a connection between the Troubles, the movies, and tourism.
Yes, well, he has a point. Tourism boards and government film boards have worked very closely together in Ireland. Film is considered a form of global branding for tourism. The philosophy is an interesting one, and has actually been around for quite a while, since Nelson Rockefeller's days. Film is considered a form of advertising for scenery. If you go to a movie and you see a lovely location, maybe you might want to go there as a tourist. So the interests of the film board and the tourism board often go hand in glove. And of course, in Ireland, they've dealt out a lot of money and a lot of tax breaks for making movies. Mr. Walker was commenting, I believe, on Michael Collins, and he was saying that the input of the Irish government amounted to a form of propaganda, that it was using film as a platform for making political statements that it could not afford to make directly.
Hmm. And there have been quite a few films made recently about Northern Ireland and Irish politics.
Yes, there have. Ireland has had an extraordinarily generous tax break plan for the film business. In this, it has followed in the footsteps of England and Australia and Canada, of course. But in Ireland, the amount of production is quite remarkable for such a small country. But again, admittedly, Ireland has many attractions for film companies. It has an excellent English-speaking and educated workforce. It has an abundance of beautiful scenery. It has a lot of interesting locations. But the problem is, I think, that there have been so many movies made that it has become a bit overly familiar. Somebody remarked to me, if they hear another slide whistle, they're going to scream.
Has tourism changed the spirit of Ireland, the feel of the place?
Well, I think a number of factors have changed the feel of the place. You know, I think Ireland became very wealthy very quickly, and I think that, generally speaking, has introduced a kind of class division there that didn't exist when I was living there 20 years ago. I think tourism is only one aspect of that phenomenon.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener, this one on line one, in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I missed the first part of this conversation, so I'm sorry if I'm repeating anything. I wanted to ask about the situation of Bhutan, which currently charges visitors about $200 a day simply to be in the country and to be a tourist. So they've been able to get a lot of money from tourism. I believe it's their second biggest industry, but they haven't been overrun with tourists, and they've been able to get a lot of tourist money on a very small infrastructure. And I was wondering if you thought that was a viable alternative for other developing countries.
I'm sorry, I missed the name of the country.
Bhutan.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll get off the line now. Thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Well, again, Bhutan is not a country that I'm personally familiar with. There is a move afoot in tourism, generally speaking, towards high-end tourism, which is perceived as a form of sustainable tourism. In other words, if you attract the luxury market, then you don't have masses of people coming in and trampling all over your landscape and your culture.
There is an organization that you mentioned in the book by the name of Business Enterprises for Sustainable Travel.
Mm-hmm.
So can travel companies be good world citizens?
Oh, I think a good many of them are making the effort to be so. There are a number of hotels in Asia which have education programs who are trying, they are trying to provide alternatives for the sex business. They're particularly aiming at young people. And admittedly, this was encouraged by a great deal of negative publicity, but they're putting these programs in place nonetheless.
Mm. One of the problems you note in the book of economies becoming dependent on tourism is the problem of dislocation, people becoming uprooted from rural areas and moving to cities. Where has this led to an especially critical problem or problems?
I think it's been particularly serious in Turkey, where farmers in regions like Antalya, for example, which is now known as the Turkish Riviera, have sold off their land to hoteliers, and many of them have moved. Many of their workers have moved. I don't think the farmers themselves are in such bad shape, but certainly a lot of poorer rural people who would have been farm laborers have moved into the cities in large numbers and have formed pockets that are particularly vulnerable to political agitation. This is one of the sources that is feeding the rise of Islamic fundamentalism in Turkey.
Over recent years, we've seen a growing interest in what's been called ecotourism. And you mentioned something in the book that I think is pretty interesting, agritourism.
Mm-hmm.
Talk with us about agritourism, and do you think it has a chance of being a healthier form of tourism?
Well, it certainly gets my vote. Agritourism is popular in Europe, particularly in countries like Italy, which have both well-established agriculture and well-established tourism. There's a perception, I think, that is primarily European, that agriculture, instead of being sort of low caste, as it were, is actually a very good means of preserving a cultural patrimony, and that the farm is a beautiful way of life, and that people like to come and stay there, and it's a means of experiencing the countryside without being stuck in a hotel, and it does provide an additional source of income for farm people, and generally does good. I don't see any downside in that.
Mm. Has tourism had detrimental effects here in the United States? Tourism is big business. I know the city of Chicago, for example, spends a lot of money trying to pull us in and get us to spend our money there.
Well, certainly speaking as a New Yorker, I can't get into a theater. I can't get into a restaurant. I can barely fight my way down Fifth Avenue. I often find myself praying audibly for a good recession.
Yeah, interesting. In the book, at the end of the book, you write about something that another interesting thing to think about, that perhaps tourism has, in a sense, has in that it has insulated us. It's become, we cocoon ourselves and then go off to Cancun or wherever.
Mm-hmm.
That we've developed a fear of one another, and we've come to rely on that way of traveling. But here at home, it seems to have had an impact in December 31st, 1999,
mm-hmm.
when we were kind of scared into staying at home and not celebrating the dawn of the new millennium.
Yes, it's one of the very few occasions on which the streets of New York were relatively quiet.
There you go. That was your opportunity. So this is, what concerns do you have about, that kind of social control?
Well, I think it folds altogether too neatly into the life as a theme park or a Disneyfication process that we all seem to be undergoing. I think we tend to experience even each other as spectator sports more and more. I had a very eerie experience in New York not too long ago. I was down in the Union Square area, and a group of tourists approached me and said very seriously, excuse me, we have heard that there is a Krispy Kreme somewhere in this neighborhood, and we would very much like to experience the Krispy Kreme experience, or words to that effect. And I must admit, I responded as a standard or Gordon New Yorker and said something to the effect of, very crustily, I have no idea. And suddenly they started to giggle, and the cameras came out, and I realized that they had trapped a bear, and they were baiting it. And, you know, I think more and more, and this is kind of a large, fuzzy point, I don't think we see each other as very real, because everything is part of a tourism entertainment. When I go to the theater now, increasingly, I find that the audience is sort of part of the spectacle, and that is distressing to me, because I grew up thinking of the theater as a kind of temple where you sort of checked yourself at the door and you went in and you experienced what was on offer there. But now it's cell phones and people talking through the performance, and even if they have paid no attention to the play itself, they jump up and give a standing ovation in which they are essentially applauding themselves as part of the show. And this just strikes me as rather bizarre. Maybe that's just me.
Well, and maybe that's the legacy of talk radio and talk television. Since you've written this book, have you made changes in the way you travel?
Well, I must admit, that's an interesting question. I like traveling the way I travel to write the book. I really like to talk to just about everyone I can get hold of when I take a trip. And whereas it was easy to do that when I first started traveling as a kid, it's harder and harder to do that now because we have become cocooned and life has become more stratified. But I hope to do another book. I hope to go and travel and talk to people with impunity once again.
Mm. And what will the topic of that book be?
I hope to go back to the Middle East.
Mm. In terms of destinations, has your thinking about travel changed?
Well, yes. One of the reasons I want to go back to the Middle East was it was the most fantastic surprise involved in doing this book. I was actually quite scared to go there before I went. But once I got there, I had to pay very careful attention, which focuses the mind wonderfully, and B, I found the people wonderfully kind and engaging and very approachable and very curious.
And where did you travel in the Mideast?
I went to Lebanon, I went to Turkey, and I went to Jordan.
Maybe you would share with our listeners the photograph that graces the cover of your book.
Oh, yeah,
that's quite
cheek.
That's quite a picture.
It's a picture of a billboard advertising French fashion, which is about the only whole structure that is left on the stretch of the Ligne de Démarcation, which is actually the road to Damascus. It's called the Ligne de Démarcation because it separates East Beirut from West Beirut. And the buildings are all in rubble. There is this enormous billboard of a rather scantily clad, very pretty young woman with a tattoo on her shoulder, and she appears to be peering over the heads of a group of traditionally dressed Arabs who are filing into one of these bombed-out buildings.
Mm. And you wonder, you know, I mean, when I look at this picture, I think, you know, well, who is this company selling this product to? And I guess my answer is you and me as tourists in this place.
You and me as tourists, and also I think the people of these countries who have lived with such severe disruption and discomfort for so many years, that the idea of creature comfort is very, very attractive to them, and can you blame them?
Those of us who travel, not as journalists, do you have any advice for us and how we might travel a little bit more responsibly and think about what we're doing?
I think you should basically travel to have a good time and to, you know, to, if possible, share something with the people of the country you're visiting. That, to me, is the most pleasurable part of travel. But that, again, is my taste. I'm not much of one for beaches and you know, organized activities. I like to wander. I like to sit in cafes. And I don't know if everybody does.
You have a favorite city?
Oh, many. I actually like Beirut very much, but that's largely because of the Beirutis. I love Paris. I will always love Dublin.
New York?
I think New York has lost its heart. I've lived here for 15 years now, and I have really seen the bohemians and the intellectuals leave. Most of my friends who are working in the theater are living up in Inwood, up in the Bronx, out in Brooklyn. There's very little of the kind of cafe society that existed when I first moved to the city, and that's largely a product of real estate. Nobody can afford it.
The biographical information on the in the book is very brief. Freelance journalist and playwright. Maybe to finish up here, maybe you just tell us about what your work in the theater has been.
Well, I've written a number of plays. I have a play called Charlie's Wedding Day, which won a National Endowment grant, and a number of others, which has been produced at the O'Neill. I wrote a play called Wars of Attrition, which was produced at Long Island Stage. I've written a number of film scripts, which appear to be caught in development hell. I had a number of plays produced both on the stage and for radio when I was living in Ireland. But I came to New York to work in the theater, and I found in moving here that my life was becoming so constricted by, well, this is a large topic and not one for this interview, largely by the way the not-for-profit funding structure has affected choice of subjects, has affected cast size. And I found that I was spending my life going to readings. And it had always been kind of a toss-up for me. I love journalism. I think if I hadn't gotten the NEA, I would have continued in it. And I found myself really, really missing the real world and really getting sick of my room and really needing to get out of it. And that's what this book did for me. It got me out of my room with a vengeance, and now I don't know if I want to go back.
Well, many happy trips out of your room.
Well, thank you, Celeste.
Patricia Goldstone has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is the author of Making the World Safe for Tourism. It is published by Yale University Press.